Let's start the story. You're listening to Beyond the Archives with the creative research team on Origin, Ways of Being. Stories. Through them, we escape, we learn, and we are inspired. We take a journey. In September 2024, the creative research team started at Lab for Living at Sheffield Hallam University to develop stories for the Ways of Being platform to optimise cultural experiences for mental health in underrepresented young people online. This meant going into archives and supporting others to do so to search for people and artifacts that told a story. We hope they moved you like they moved us, but if they didn't, we hope that these stories inspire you to investigate the archives for yourselves and find stories that are meaningful to you. In this podcast, we explore the impact that these stories had on us and others, how they inspired us, and how they ultimately were placed on the Ways of Being website. Take a pew and have a listen. We'd also love to hear your thoughts.
For people who are grieving things that have been lost, sometimes the most containing aspect of being outside in the landscape is that it doesn't offer you platitudes and expectations that a well-meaning person might. It doesn't wish you to be fixed or better, but offers a witnessing that so many of us really need as we navigate the losses. Hello.
How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Good.
Think, if it's all right, could you just give us a bit of a background on the story that you did?
So, I guess at the heart of it is an ambient track. So the ambient track is inspired by a particular location in the Peak District that I'm particularly fond of, aware of its history and context. But I wanted to explore it further using audio-visual techniques. It's inspired about how places can be haunted by context and how we often find locations in the world that feel a little bit off and a bit uncanny. They're not necessarily dark places or bad or dangerous. They just feel a little bit unsettling, like something has happened there or something is yet to happen. These are particularly more intensified. And I think as humans, we're somewhat attracted to these areas, kind of seduced by the unknown of it. But it's when you start to understand the context of that place, the history of it, it only deepens that connection. So the piece is about a place in the Peak District called Green's Paper Mill, which was formerly a paper mill dam. And before that, it was a lead smelting site. And less than a mile away, there's the remains of a Catholic chapel and 2,000-year-old earthworks that were a settlement for Romano British settlers in the area.
I think it's important here to kind of note your background as well and maybe how you came across this area in specific.
Cool. So I'm a Peak District folklorist. I specialise in unearthing these stories in various mediums. And this was a particular medium that I wanted to explore. So prior to this project, I had this particular piece in mind and I thought it would be a good opportunity to pursue it under the structure of this project.
For me, kind of going through the sort of the audiovisual journey, as you say, I think that, I mean, the way that I visualised it was it that you were looking at layers, or you're looking at kind of folds in a landscape and kind of unfolding them to explore them further. I think it's interesting what you say about something feeling maybe uncanny or off, or something different about a particular part of the landscape, and then actually going and exploring, is there a reason why it feels that way? I do have a question. And my question is, what led you to the site? Is it somewhere you've walked to before and you felt that? Or was it more that you've looked it up previously through your work and you thought, actually, this is the opportunity to unfold that? So.
Well, in the scope of multi-layering, it's a lot of things. Yep. So personally, I'm from the area that is nearby to it, which is a village called Hathersage. I've grown up in this area. So first and foremost, it's a landscape that is attached to my childhood. I spent many years playing in that area, swimming in the dam, in the waters, playing in the river, playing hide and seek in the bracken. So it's a place of adventure. And then it's also attached to my adolescence, early adolescence. So growing up with my friends, you kind of continue that play mentality. You're exploring your own worlds with a bit more freedom. Again, that played a part in it. And that location also played a part in my early adult life, where I seemed to naturally return to it as a place of refuge to help deal with feelings of anxiety and depression. And I think possibly there is a link to those previous experiences in my life, kind of returning to a landscape which might not necessarily have changed that much, but personal emotions have definitely shaped the way that I see it. So personally, there's a lot of layers going on. But then externally, there's also historical layers going on.
I mean, one thing you said there, I was thinking about my own experience actually, but returning to a place that hasn't necessarily changed, but either you've changed or shifted, or something has happened in your life that's meant that you're in a different headspace maybe. I think my question there is, does the landscape kind of feel different and look different when it has been imbued by a certain significance and then it changes? I think for example, I'm thinking of my own kind of, I grew up in the countryside and there's a bridle path and there's like a very small stream beside the bridle path. But when I was like four, it was huge and it felt so big, and it felt like the banks were cliffs. And then going back over time, I increasingly thought, oh my goodness, that's so small.
Yes.
But the meaning changes, but I'm always kind of in awe by the fact that my connection to that landscape is still fresh, but feels different, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's the landscape, not necessarily physically changing, but our ability to notice other things. I brought this book along with me. So I'm currently reading it, and I read a chapter last night that kind of felt very apt. So it's by a friend called Ruth Allen, and she's an ecotherapist.
Okay.
And this book is about how lessons from geology and landscape can help us deal with feelings that arise in therapy. So I'll probably find a quote that might help navigate that question. So, in grief, we are made nomads in our most familiar places, strangers to our friends, unfamiliar to ourselves. There is no going back to a landscape you knew before grief, because you are now irrevocably in a different place. The valleys will not infill and flatten out. There will always now be the spectre of shadow on the lee side of the sunlit uplands. A shadow that was always there, but never seen in the young days before things started to disappear. So that kind of centres on grief. So my personal things might seep into grief, but it's not exclusively grief. But I do like that aspect that things can change through experience, because you get just a different lens. You learn new things and your scope changes based on other experiences. But yeah, I think there's another quote later on that kind of ties to reflecting on a landscape. So it's about how we have many geographies in one lifetime. So it's, what builds over time is a paleogeography of grief. Hopefully we look back and see the old dwellings, the old lowlands and channels that all hurt ran through for a while. It's levee breaches, it's floodplains. We may see the fossils of friendships lost and plans discarded. We can look at it all from a newer vantage point, from within a new geography. So it's about admiring previous geographies and stuff. So yeah, I'm very much drawn to that in my own personal discovery. Nature and landscape's been a huge part of my therapy, because it observes and witnesses.
Yeah.
And it's quite unforgiving sometimes as well.
Yeah, and it can hold a lot within it. I think it can hold
it
so
holds,
much.
It holds,
so
a capacity to
absolutely
hold. That's it.
So many different layers kind of on top of each other, and you can kind of see and feel that at one point, and that's such a fascinating kind of multiplicity there.
Yeah.
I think you also touched on two of my favourite things, which is psychogeography and ontology, which I think you can probably tell. but absolutely, about how the landscape can just hold and has that ability to hold, and not only kind of hold but also hold to account.
Yes.
I think something that came through in the video was the soundscaping. Obviously, I know it was an ambient track.
Yeah.
But you also used some sounds like kind of children's laughter. Mm-hmm. Kind of, I think they were like horses' reins, right?
Yeah,
that's the right sound. Why did you kind of bring those two things together?
So to tie it in with the kind of previous point with the layers, you can kind of look at each context separately and observe it. So like, for example, 2,000 years ago when settlers were there, and my experience, so you've got vastly different eras, is when they start to interact with each other, they create a sound that's not really been heard before in that one particular landscape. So I like the idea of playing with children laughing and playing around, a sound that would have been heard by my parents, but it's a sound that's heard by people 2,000 years ago. So it's kind of, things have not really changed that much in that particular area. I wanted to use sounds of industry because it once used to be a really noisy site of industry, so you'd have big wind wheels turning and creating power. You'd have lots of banging and clanging around, and the place now is just really eerily quiet, and there's not even any bird song there.
Really?
There's no bird song in that place. As soon as you step out of that location, the birds return.
That's really interesting.
So it's, I really wanted to layer these eras and see how they would create a piece of music. Not necessarily musical, but I wanted to experiment. So I kind of didn't have an idea of what this track was going to sound like. It kind of evolved by accident, which I kind of enjoyed.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what you're talking about there is that these kind of unchanging points of connection that as humans we have. Like, I mean, children are always going to laugh, for instance.
Yeah.
I think something that stuck with me from the video were kind of the motifs of kind of water. So the brook that will have been used by all of those people and all of those different layers, and the importance of water, but also the importance of kind of the brickwork that was there and what can sit within brick.
I started this project with the question of, can buildings have emotion? Do buildings have emotion? And the obvious answer is no, because they're not human. We tend to tie emotions with humans, but it's how these bricks have been hewn and manipulated and used, and what's gone inside the buildings, what's gone on inside the buildings. Does that, this is kind of like a porous rock in this area, so naturally does it kind of like, can it hold like those echoes in a way? And I would believe that they do.
Yeah, and I also believe that, and there's lots of people that don't. But even if that's not something that happens, it's something, are we bringing those echoes? Or I was just thinking actually about earlier walking around the corridor in the basement of Lab for Living. It's cold, it's dark. I don't like it.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel nice. Yeah. I don't enjoy walking down there. Is that something that I'm bringing because I have a very active imagination? Maybe, but I do like to think about kind of who else has used this space over time and what's been there. I think that's quite an interesting thing to think about. And kind of complicates sort of our interactions with a space as well in a way that I think it maybe brings something new. As well, right?
Being drawn to humans we don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think, I know that you've talked previously about, I mean, what I really liked about this story is actually it didn't really focus in on anyone in particular or any one individual. And I know we've spoken previously about how do we sort of bring life to a story when we'd about a person when we didn't know the person. How do we, what can we bring, what can we understand, what can we insert? And so I really like that it kind of actually, you sort of almost avoided that question completely by saying these are things that we know, but this is what you can feel at this site, mm-hmm. for instance.
Absolutely. It's open-ended, and there's no right way to view this piece. You can listen to this piece without seeing anything,
mm-hmm.
or you could view it without listening to something, and you'd have a different reaction. Or you can view it 3 times and pick up on something each time.
Mm-hmm.
I exclusively wanted to make it an open-ended thing,
mm-hmm.
where everybody could access it and everybody's reaction or takeaway from it was valid.
Mm-hmm.
And that's particularly why I chose the field of ambient music,
mm-hmm.
because it lends itself so well to that kind of exploration, reflection of your own personal experiences. So
I was going to ask you about kind of the choices around ambient music, because that felt super important as well. And
yeah.
I mean, a lot of careful consideration obviously went into this story, and it felt like from my perspective at least that you kind of had, although everything was quite open-ended and how someone felt coming out of that, it did feel like you had a purpose in mind, that these were conscious choices and mindful choices that you were making. I don't know if you
absolutely
agree. Yeah.
I composed it on an online music lab, I guess you'd call it, piece of music composing software. It had about 16 layers of tracks, mm-hmm. that kind of overlapped, but the file names of each layer were quite telling. Obviously, I was just creating. I wasn't really thinking, which is quite a nice way to reveal the fact that I named some of the layers like healing,
mm-hmm.
or hope or oppressive. They kind of reflected, mm-hmm. periods of my life or certain emotions, and you can notice the overlaps between those tracks. So it goes from a quite a dark, oppressive theme to a lighter, more ethereal tone towards, mm-hmm. the end of the track. That was intentional,
mm-hmm.
and you can see that through my choices made, mm-hmm. throughout that. So going back, I can actually pinpoint the choices, mm-hmm. that I made, which is, yeah. quite nice.
Yeah. No, I mean, I liked it a lot, and it was something that I think ambient music has been used before a lot for kind of meditative practices. I think that the way that it sounds, it felt very much like I was almost doing a bit of a mindfulness exercise throughout it, which I really enjoyed. but it also allowed, I think it allowed for space, which I quite liked as
good.
Well,
yes.
Yeah,
well, yeah, you've touched upon things that are intentional. I have an affiliation of ambient music because of my process of healing,
mm-hmm.
I think that subconsciously comes from meditative practices, music you find on apps and all that kind of stuff. Now it's part of my daily life, or my Spotify recommendation. Most of my recommended playlists are ambient sounds, mm-hmm. they call it. It's not even music. But I listen to that to work, to relax, to and spend time in nature.
Mm-hmm.
So it comes from that place. But in this particular track, I did want it to act as a meditative practice without telling someone to take these amount of breaths in, mm. and out. So I recorded myself breathing at that pace,
mm.
and it's all set to that BPM.
Wow.
So it's set to a certain BPM,
mm.
that induces that meditative, mm. reaction without you really knowing.
Mm.
So it subconsciously triggers that,
mm.
which what I wanted,
yeah.
the effect to be, so I'm glad you picked up on that.
Yeah, I did feel very relaxed whilst watching and listening. Which, yeah, it's really interesting. I haven't heard of someone kind of matching that to sort of breath before. And I think maybe it is a bit like you imbue it with a lot of choice, which I think is, yeah, important to know as well. Like I as the listener, I can kind of interact or engage with it as much or as little as kind of is necessary or is needed at that time. And I think it's certainly quite different to to other story forms that kind of come to mind for myself. But it is a story, you know, you go on a journey throughout it, and I like that it doesn't come to any conclusions. It's like this is here, and that's what I'm saying about it.
That's it. Yeah. It doesn't. There has no ending really. Mm. I like to pick up on that continuation of it.
Mm.
I was inspired by another reference was This Country, the comedy on BBC Three.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mockumentary, but I really love the data that they provide, which is text format over shots of nature. And it's weirdly relaxing, informative, and it doesn't take you anywhere necessarily, but you get the information that you need, and it directs a story, and it helps the narrative of the comedy, even though it's a really serious, real piece of information. It's statistics, really. I really was inspired that, so I took that element and applied it to this.
Mm.
As a reference point.
I love that. I feel like This Country is such an odd mix of different disparate elements that work so well together.
It's my reference point in all sorts of things that I do, because it touches on my upbringing and how to present that kind of weirdness of country living.
Absolutely. I mean, it resonated with me as well, coming from a village.
Yeah.
But I think going back to the sound, I kind of wanted to pause around where you said that, you know, when visiting this site, there was an absence of birds and bird song.
Yeah.
And maybe like an absence of sound generally. But when you've recreated this, you've obviously imbued it with a lot of sound and a lot of different sounds. I didn't particularly have a question there, and that was just something I found quite fascinating, that it feels like, when I watched that, it felt like I'm kind of surrounded by this sound, whereas perhaps that, I don't know, is that the sound that you imagine when you're there but isn't there, or is that something else?
I think so. I think it's picking up on that it's all about frequencies, that kind of static energy and unsettling energy. It's an imagined soundscape, which came from one of my references, which I'll come into.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's power in imagining what a place might sound like, as opposed to actually recording a sound, recording a place, So that track does include real field recordings, but it also combines with this imagined fantasy realm.
Yeah.
It creates that kind of off kind of result.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think most people would definitely understand the experience of going somewhere and feeling things that were off, or hearing things perhaps. I know that, country lanes around me, I don't enjoy walking down them at night, for instance, because all the noises seem different at night than they do during the day. And I will,
context.
Absolutely, and I will imagine different noises and different things sound like different things. Yeah. But and also silence can be really creepy.
Well, they're both quite scary. Both primal reactions.
Yeah.
If you're in a woodland and there's no bird sound, it's usually because there's a predator around.
Mm. Yeah.
So when we're as animals in a place with no bird sound, that primal learning still is with us.
Mm.
And so it's used in horror films and the like. When there's no birds singing, something's nearby.
Yeah.
Usually it's us that's causing that. But I think there's something not quite right with those kind of landscapes.
Yeah, it's usually foreboding.
It's foreboding, I mean, Paper Mill Dam is still a place, it's a beautiful place, but there's some, I call it dark green.
Mm.
It's a very green, lovely place, but it's slightly dark and cold, and you're always looking around your shoulder just in case. And I don't know what that is. It's haunted by something.
And I think, I mean, I brought up to you the Stone Tapes before the film. But I mean, I don't know the person listening will have heard of Stone Tapes, but the fact that there are kind of recordings in stone, and they are kind of on top of one another, and basically the premise is they've decided to somehow create a new kind of recording equipment out of this particular type of stone, because it can hold within it actually sound specifically, but also sort of the image of a person. But they accidentally delete one layer And then underneath it is something that's older
mm-hmm.
and darker
yeah.
and has been warped over time as well, which I found really cool, really fascinating
yeah.
the way that they did it, because it was so, it had become not understandable, whereas
yes.
the previous layers were human,
yeah.
were understandable, but it had gone that one step too far removed
yes.
the other
yeah,
way,
yeah,
and
yeah.
it was really creepy and uncanny. Obviously, it's what, 60s, 70s,
it's
a it's pretty
a
bad
great
film, but
bomb
like,
experiment
it's,
though,
yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah.
But it taps into that classic statement in folk horror, is that we don't go back. And when we do go back, we discover things that are unsettling, even
mm.
though they probably are human
mm.
at some stage in their existence.
Yeah, but a lurking beneath.
Yeah.
So, yeah, really very fascinating way to kind of bring that all together within kind of meditation and
yeah.
kind of making someone feel so relaxed whilst thinking about what kind of is hiding beneath is really, yeah,
it's
a very cool way of doing it.
It opens questions, and I'm sure the people listening to this
mm.
are probably finding some elements of this vastly strange and new and quite artsy, and
mm.
you have to use that kind of open-mindedness to access that kind of thing.
Mm.
But I also wanted to present something that you could just watch
mm.
as a documentary piece.
Yeah.
And then not have to or need to go further.
Mm.
So I wanted to have two access points, really.
Mm. Well, you're leaving it at people's door.
Yeah.
And they can open that if they want.
Yeah,
and that's really nice.
It's that kind of witnessing element to it. And
absolutely,
as you said earlier,
yeah.
that holding of it.
Yeah.
So you can go to somewhere, express what you need to express or think
mm.
about something, and it will hold it.
Mm.
And sometimes when we return to a landscape that we've been to in the past,
mm.
we might be accessing
mm.
those holdings, potentially. It could be quite comforting as well if the place does feel it's slightly off,
mm-hmm.
and we're ourselves feeling slightly off.
Mm.
There's a symmetry going on, there's a mirroring going on. So if a place doesn't necessarily feel beautiful or like comforting, it can still feel comfortable.
Mm.
That's something that I found quite relevant in my life.
Mm.
But then when you go back in and you are feeling different, it's an amazing place.
Mm.
It's the same place, but you can access it at different periods of your life.
Yeah.
So.
Different eyes,
different
lenses.
Eyes, yeah.
yeah.
And there's loads of these landscapes around me. The Peak District's a hugely popular place
mm.
and filled with beauty spots, but personally, I have my spots.
Mm.
I call them secret spots.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not necessarily amazing, but there's just certain locations that are connected to me
mm-hmm.
and I'm connected to them, and they're more, way more important to me than the tourist spots. No one knows about them.
Well, I won't ask you to say any right now. We can leave it on. It'll be a thought of, yeah, find your secret spots, whatever they
yeah,
are, those spots that have, that resonate
yeah.
with you. I think I certainly have them. They're not in the Peak District, but they're somewhere else.
They can be in cities,
yeah.
they can be everywhere, and taking time to find out more about them,
mm.
even if it's a small history, or has no history at all, you're taking time to respect that place a little bit more,
mm.
and respect yourself.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, it's been great.